Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Emergency Critical Care Webinar Club. I'm Laurent Garrassé, and I'm going to discuss with you today common acute spinal disease. What I'm going to focus particularly today are four common acute spinal injuries, which are ischemic myelopathy, disc herniation, exogenous spinal trauma, and we'll finish with a common complaint in general practice called sacrococcygeal dislocation, also commonly known as tail-pull injury. What I would like to give you today is pretty much the essential about this condition, discussing briefly about their pathophysiology, how do we diagnose them, or how do we suspect them from a clinical point of view, what are the principles of treatment, and the general prognosis of this condition. So all the kind of information that are important for your activity in critical care medicine. Remember that this condition that we're going to discuss come into a general diagnostic approach. If you've previously listened to a lecture webinar that I've done, I always tend to approach neurological case the same way, following this golden rule. The first one is, are you dealing with a neurological problem? And it's particularly relevant when you have an animal presented to you with difficulty using his leg or being totally paralyzed. The vast majority may have a spinal problem, but you need to remember that other condition could mimic a spinal problem, including, for example, orthopedic disease. So, for example, with a dog, the common pitfall would be a dog with cruciate ligament rupture, and it can sometimes be bilateral. For a cat, it could be, for example, bilateral femoral fracture or pelvic fracture, as well as aortic thromboembolism. And all these non-neurological condition could easily mimic a spinal problem. So remember, before to rush to consider neurological disease, take the time to rule out non-neurological problem. The second thing is to make sure you are looking at the right place, and that means establishing an anatomic diagnosis before to consider any spinal condition. Anatomic diagnosis for spinal disease means trying to localize which part of the spinal cord is affected. And that has many advantages. The first one is to narrow down, obviously, your investigation. That have obviously cost and time implication if you focus only on the area where you suspect the problem to be. But it also helps you to make diagnosis of condition, for example, fibrocartilaginous embolism, which often are diagnosed by exclusion of other mimic. And as we're going to see, the only way to diagnose this type of condition is often by making sure we're looking at the right place and ruling out condition that will have the same type of presentation, and we come back to that. When you know where you should look, the next step is to establish an etiological diagnosis, which in essence means coming up with a short list of likely conditions that could explain the clinical presentation. And then, when you've done that, you can cherry pick which diagnostic test will help you to explore this differential. And the outcome of that may be that you can positively identify a condition, or you may be able to narrow down to only one condition and make in that case what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. With spinal disease, the other thing to keep in mind is also the prognosis. Despite all the advance in diagnostic imaging, most of the spinal condition will be prognosed on the basis of the neurological examination. And as we're going to see, there is a grading system that we frequently use for paraparetic or paraplegic patients that help us to assign a grade to a patient. And from that, depending on what condition you're dealing with or suspect, you can give the odd for recovery to the owner. And frequently, this is where the prognosis go in terms of how much you can inform the owner of the chance of recovery. MRI give you a lot of detail, but will very often not give you much more information about the prognosis, but sometimes can tell you it's actually worse than you thought from the clinical examination. How do we establish an etiological diagnosis? In neurology, we always use this mnemonic, which is a way to remember all the disease process that can affect the nervous system. And the mnemonic that I frequently use is vitamin D. And all these letters stand for a disease process that could potentially affect the nervous system. V stands for vascular, I for inflammatory infectious, T for traumatic or toxic, A for anomalous, which means malformation, M for metabolic disease, I for idiopathic, N for neoplastic, and D stands for degenerative. Why we do that? Because on the basis of the historical information provided by the owner, I am able to narrow down to two or three possibilities. And why that? Because each of these disease processes have a typical mode of onset and progression with time. What we're going to focus today are disease with acute onset, and that narrow down to vascular or traumatic spinal disease, which typically have a sudden onset, and then they either remain the same in terms of severity of the sign, or slowly get better with time, but they should not get worse with time. This is in contrast to more progressive onset conditions such as inflammatory, infectious, or neoplastic disease, which frequently will have a more gradual onset and get worse with time. One exception with spinal disease will be animal that could decompensate from either neoplastic or infectious disease. And as an example, dog or cat can have neoplasia affecting the vertebrae, causing low-grade back pain until a point where this animal develops a pathological fracture and therefore will present quite acutely with neurological sign and back or neck pain while the disease process was there for a while. With inflammatory infectious, another exception causing fairly rapid onset would be dog with spinal epidural empyema. But as a rule, when the onset is acute, you're thinking more along the line of vascular and traumatic disease. Metabolic disease does not apply to spinal cord disease, but typically they tend to wax and wane. And therefore, if you got a dog presented to you as an emergency with waxing and waning weakness on his back leg, especially if he go through a period of normality and then quite marked neurological sign waxing and waning, therefore you can be confident you are not dealing with a spinal problem, and that should raise the suspicion of a metabolic disorder or potentially a neuromuscular condition. Going back to spinal disease, another way we narrow them down is whether or not the animal is painful on examination. And spinal disease can be divided in painful and non-painful condition. Painful conditions are commonly disc herniation. And in that category, I will say that the extrusion are usually far more painful than the protrusion, but we come back to that. Discal spondylitis, fracture luxation, tumor outside of the spinal cord tissue, which we refer as extramedullary tumor, and finally the inflammatory disease of the spinal cord, meningitis or meningomyelitis. Non-painful disease come down to ischemic myelopathy, degenerative myelopathy, vertebral malformation, and intramedullary tumor. So you see that already from a clinical ground, by asking the right question to the owner, how did it occur? Did the animal get worse? We can narrow down already to two or three possibilities. And then examining the dog and palpating and manipulating his spine, finding out if it's painful or not, you can even narrow down further. And you will perform diagnostic tests to then challenge the remaining differential diagnosis. So we're going to review four of the common acute spinal injury that we tend to see in veterinary medicine. The first one is ischemic myelopathy. We'll then move on to discuss disc herniation and the different type of disc herniation we see, exogenous spinal trauma, and we'll finish talking about sacrococcygeal dislocation. Ischemic myelopathy is the term given to describe vascular accident of the spinal cord. And probably the easiest one for a pet owner to understand, it's the equivalent of a stroke in the spinal cord. Stroke are vascular accident of the brain, while ischemic myelopathy are vascular accident of the spinal cord. The most common cause for this ischemic myelopathy, at least in dog, and we see it also in cat, is fibrocartilaginous embolism, also referred as FCE. However, fibrocartilaginous embolism is an histological diagnosis, and therefore, you should be mindful of using that term antemortem, and I personally prefer to use the generic term of ischemic myelopathy. In fact, there could be other sources of ischemic myelopathy aside from FCE, other products can have embolism, including neoplastic embolism, septic embolism, hyperlipidemia, parasitic embolism, or embolism could be the consequence of blood hyperviscosity. What's happening at the level of the spinal cord? The spinal cord is, like any organ, has an arterial and vascular blood supply. In terms of arterial blood supply, the spinal cord is segmented and divided in many different spinal cord segments. And for each spinal cord segment, there is a pair of arteries feeding the spinal cord. These arteries divide into dorsal and ventral branch, and each of these smaller arteries will then penetrate the parenchyma and are end arteries, which means that there is very little collateral blood supply. In this drawing there, you can see that depending on which artery, there is a territory that this artery will supply, either dorsal or ventral part of the spinal cord. To complicate that, in some area of the spinal cord, and especially the cervical spine, there may be a dominant artery, which means that instead of having a very homogeneous distribution between right and left, which is shared between the right and left spinal branch, one of the spinal branch, either the right or the left one, may be the one that supply the entire section of the spinal cord. In terms of what are the mechanisms to explain fibrocartilaginous embolism, there are many different hypotheses, in essence six of them, but the common point between all these hypotheses is that at some point, some material, fibrocartilaginous material, which likely come from the nucleus pulposus, find its way within the arterial tree of the spinal cord and cause an occlusion of this spinal cord vascularization. If you've got lack of blood supply to a portion of the spinal cord, we've already seen that due to the fact there is very little overlap and collateral blood supply due to this end artery system, the spinal cord will quickly, there will be ischemia. And if the ischemia is severe or prolonged, that will result in infarction. In terms of tissue sensitivity, the gray matter in the spinal cord, which is at the center, which you can see there, is particularly sensitive to ischemia and less sensitive than the white matter. But the consequence of a lack of blood supply will be an ischemic or infarction of the territory that are supplied by the occluded small artery of the spinal cord. In terms of clinical presentation, being a vascular accident, the onset will be typically acute or peracute and non-progressive with time. However, due to the development of the secondary spinal cord injury, which is a cascade of biochemical and vascular events that take place following the primary insult, you may have a deterioration of the neurological sign for the first few hours. But I would say past 6 hours, it's very unlikely to get any further. The presentation of an FCE will therefore be an acute or peracute myelopathy that is non-progressive, non-painful. And as we're going to see when we're using diagnostic imaging, it's a non-compressive myelopathy. In terms of what clinical sign you may have beyond the presentation as being acute or peracute in onset, the myelopathic sign very much depend on the location of the occlusion. And if you got occlusion in the cervical spine, then you may have hemiparesis or tetraparesis. Well, if the occlusion take place in a spinocord segment caudal to T3 spinocord segment, then you may have paraparesis or monoparesis. The sign, therefore, only reflect the location of the vascular insult. They are often lateralized, meaning that the neurological sign on the limb may be unilateral, and you may have monoparesis or plegia or hemiparesis, or they are often asymmetrical, affecting more one sign than the other. And this is more often the case in the when the cervical spinal cord is affected due to the what I was explaining you a minute ago, the fact that in the cervical spine you got more unilateral artery supplying the spinal cord parenchyma. How do we diagnose fibrocartilaginous embolism? Depending on the imaging modality you use, it is often a diagnosis of exclusion. The diagnosis of fibrocartilaginous embolism can only be made by post-mortem, but ante-mortem, you can make a presumptive diagnosis of ischemic myelopathy. You will make that diagnosis taking into account the history, acute or peracute onset of spinal cord sign, and by ruling out non-compressive myelopathy, which could mimic the same history. And in essence, that would mean ruling out disc herniation, as well as spinal trauma. In terms of CSF finding, the CSF is often normal in ischemic myelopathy or show non-specific sign, which may be mild nuclear neutrophilic pleocytosis and or mild elevation in total protein. If you're using myelography to investigate spinal disease, it's something that you will perform following plain X-ray, and the plain X-ray will be important in that case to investigate the possibility of spinal trauma, especially spinal fracture or subluxation. And following plain X-ray, you will do myelogram, and the myelogram with ischemic myelopathy will be often normal or in more rare case show an intramedullary pattern due to the spinal cord edema. And that is a good way to remind you how important it is to localize the lesion. On the left, you can see a myelogram in the caudal cervical spine. And if I localize the lesion to this portion of the spinal cord, and I've got a dog with a peracute onset of spinal cord sign referring to that part of the spinal cord, finding nothing has in that case a meaning, it means I'm dealing with an ischemic myelopathy. So you see that localizing and following this golden rule of neurology help you to make sense of normal finding, which in that case imply an ischemic myelopathy. MRI scan is the imaging modality of choice, but I appreciate it may not be accessible to everyone. It is the imaging modality of choice because it will help you not only to rule out mimic of ischemic myelopathy, and in essence disc herniation or spinal fracture subluxation, but it will very often help you to identify the tell sign of a vascular accident, which will be the edema within the spinal cord. And you can see a beautiful example here in the cervical spine, where you can see changes worse on the right side, which is this side, compared to the left. And especially the changes are more marked in the gray matter. And you can see also white matter edema as well. So in that case, it doesn't tell you it is an ischemic myelopathy on its own, but in the context of the presentation, which is acute or peracute onset of spinal cord sign, ruling out other mimic and finding this type of changes will bring you as close as possible as you can be of a diagnosis of ischemic myelopathy. an example here of a cat with also an ischemic myelopathy. This cat was showing acute onset of hemiparesis on the left, and you can see it's knuckling on the left front, and it was also knuckling on left hind. That brought us to suspect a cervical myelopathy, and this is the dorsal view of the MRI of this cat, and you can see some changes within the spinal cord there, worse on one side than while sparing the other side. This is the transverse view that again show you some changes that are mostly affecting one side while sparing the other. Again, when you've got this type of changes, a vascular accident should be highly suspected. It is, there's not many disease processes that have the ability to affect only one side of the spinal cord while sparing the other one. But this is, a clear-cut example. Ischemic myelopathy can also affect symmetrically both sides of the spinal cord. But when it is so asymmetrical, then it's another way to reinforce the suspicion of ischemic myelopathy. How do we treat ischemic myelopathy? The treatment is mostly supportive care, and that means it very much depends on the degree of disability of the animal. What I mean by supportive care, if an animal is recumbent, then you need to take care of putting the animal on a thick mattress, turning him regularly, and also addressing all the other consequences with regard to bladder management, feeding, and also hydration of the animal. So if the animal is unable to move on his own, you may have to consider fluid therapy as well. But overall, it's mostly supportive care as well as physiotherapy and hydrotherapy. And hydrotherapy is something that can be started pretty much straight away. While with disc extrusion, if you treat them conservatively or post-surgery, you will have to be cautious starting hydrotherapy, and you may delay that for a week or two. With ischemic myelopathy, there is no reason to start hydrotherapy straight away. The prognosis depends very much on the degree of disability. As a rule, if an animal is presented paraplegic with no nociception, if the nociception is still absent within 24 hours of the onset, then I will give a grave prognosis to the owner. If the animal has nociception, then intuitively, if the animal is plegic, it will take longer than a paretic animal. But overall, pending nociception is still intact, you will expect the animal to make good improvement within the two to four weeks. The time it will take to assess the full improvement may take about 2 to 3 months. You will notice on that slide that I didn't include any drug therapy. There is no evidence to support the use of methylprednisolone sodium succinate in the treatment of ischemic myelopathy. The benefits are outweighed by all the side effects, especially gastrointestinal side effects, risk of infection on the recumbent animal, and that's the reason why I personally not use methylprednisolone sodium succinate in this case. The second condition we're going to discuss is disc herniation going through the different type and different manifestation of disc herniation. Disc herniation is a general term to describe two types of herniation. The first one is the extrusion, the second one is the protrusion. And both these type of disc herniation follow a type of disc degeneration, namely chondroid metaplasia or fibroid degeneration. So discussing them separately, the first type of disc herniation we're going to discuss is the disc extrusion. Disc extrusion is the most common type of disc herniation, and it tends to follow type 1 disc disease. Type 1 disc disease is what you see commonly in chondrodystrophic breed, chondrodystrophic, the most common one being Dachshund. And what's happened in this breed is that by 2 years of age, every single intervertebral disc in their spine is diseased. The intervertebral disc, to remind you, is made of two parts, the center, which is the nucleus pulposus, and the outer layer, which is the annulus fibrosus. And the role of the disc is very much a cushion between the vertebrae. It provides flexibility to the spine and allowing movement and avoiding the vertebrae to rub between each other. With chondrodystrophic breed, due to their genetic makeup, the issue is with the nucleus pulposus. This nucleus pulposus is usually has a very high water content, which allowed this cushioning effect. In chondrodystrophic breed, they are born with abnormal nucleus, and frequently there is a lack of a molecule called proteoglycan, which is responsible for keeping the water molecule bound within the nucleus pulposus. Having a reduced concentration of proteoglycan, the nucleus pulposus is unable to maintain the water content and become very quickly dehydrated. So by 2 years of age, every single intervertebral disc of a chondrodystrophic breed has undergone to some degree this type of type 1 disc degeneration. And that will mean, in terms of spinal mobility, loss of the cushioning effect between the vertebrae. And in places in the spine where there is a lot of motion, especially bending and rotational movement, which is often the cervical spine and the thoracolumbar region, the dorsal part of the annulus will have wear and tears. And after sometime a small trauma, the content of the nucleus, which is now stiff and dehydrated, will make its way through the bridge of the annulus and extrude within the vertebral canal, pressing onto the spinal cord. And that's what we call a disc extrusion. So this type 1 disc disease tend to affect chondrodystrophic breed, which you got the list here, but the most common one being the dachshund. And the onset of type 1 disc disease leading to extrusion is often very acute in onset. The age of onset will also be young adult dog. The reason for that is by 2 years of age, every single disc is diseased. And frequently, you tend to see this chondrodystrophic breed between 3 and 7. The youngest I've seen was 15 months of age. While for most of us, you expect this disease more in the adult or older, human. Dachshund is 10 times more at risk than any other breed, and there is probably not 1 week where we don't have at Davis 1 or 2 dachshund referred to us. In terms of where the disc tend to occur, 85% between T11 and L3 and 50% between T12 and L1. It is exceptional to have a disc extrusion in the thoracic spine between T2 and T10. And the reason for that is that you got an extra ligament preventing the disc to extrude, which is the intercapital ligament. What is the other type of disc herniation is what we refer as disc protrusion, and it usually follows type 2 disc disease. Type 2 disc disease tend to affect mostly large or giant breed of dog, and while type 1 disc disease was caused by an issue with the nucleus pulposus, in type 2 the issue is with the annulus fibrosus. Type 1 disc disease was affecting every single disc, while type 2 disc disease only affects certain discs in the spine. So what is type 2 disc disease? It is a reaction of a normal disc to excessive load. Excessive load is the abnormal forces that will occur in certain discs in the spine, especially discs in the caudal cervical spine, the thoracolumbar region and the lumbosacral region, which are very mobile structure, where a lot of, again, bending forces and rotational forces will take place. And that ultimately will cause disruption in the organization of the annular fibers, especially dorsally. And as a reaction to that, the disc will undergo type 2 disc degenerations, will consist of thickening of the dorsal annulus, which become thicker and thicker, and will slowly bulge and then protrude within the vertebral canal. In addition to that, you may have dehydration of the nucleus pulposus, and other sign of type 2 disc disease, including ventral or lateral spondylosis. So as you see in the difference between type 1 and type 2, type 1 affect every single disc, but not all of them will extrude, while type 2 affect only certain discs in the spine. Type 2 disc disease is something that we'll see in a more progressive onset. The animal will not have this sharp pain that usually you see with disc extrusion, and it tend to affect more middle-aged to older non-chondrodystrophoid large breed of dog. The exception to the presentation of more progressive onset will be dogs that have progressive protrusion, and as this happens very slowly in the spinal cord has the ability to adapt to that. And with a fall or with a jump, you may then have an acute and chronic deterioration due mostly to the contusive effect of this chronic disc that has been compromising for weeks or months the spinal cord. What about cat? Cat tend to get disc herniation far less frequently than dog, but they can also get intervertebral disc disease and herniation. The age of onset is usually around 8, so it's more a disease of the adult or older cat. When the disc is clinically relevant, meaning causing pain and or myelopathic sign, it's usually a disc extrusion. And it tend to affect mostly the thoracolumbar lesion and the mid lumbar spinal cord. In terms of pathophysiology, what you need to know about disc herniation to understand the treatment principle is that when the disc slipped, especially with an acute disc, two things will happen. The compression, which is the physical displacement of the spinal cord by the disc, and the contusion, which is basically, in simple terms, the bruising caused by the disc as is herniating. And this contusion will lead to a number of cascade of events within the spinal cord, which are the primary damage, which is called the primary injury, vascular disruption, conduction block, hemorrhage, and vasospasm. And then you got the secondary injury phenomenon, which I've briefly discussed with ischemic myelopathy, which is a cascade of biochemical and also neurogenic and electrolyte changes within the spinal cord that will aggravate the primary injury. In terms of what we can act on, from a therapeutic point of view, the margin of action is very limited with disc herniation. As a surgeon, you can potentially remove the compression if the compression is significant enough to justify the clinical sign. But in terms of addressing the contusion, the best way to do that is mostly, if the animal is systemically unstable, to make sure it's got good blood supply to the spinal cord, good oxygenation, which, you know, with most disc herniation, which should not be an issue. When we talk about spinal trauma, this is the best way to avoid the secondary injury phenomenon. But still, there is no magic drug that will help to prevent this secondary injury phenomenon. And with regard to disc herniation, I again not use methylprednisolone sodium succinate. There has been recent evidence in dog on grade 5 paraplegia dog that compare placebo, methylprednisolone sodium succinate, and also PEG, polyethylene glycol, that show no benefit in giving either PEG or methylprednisolone compared to placebo. How do we diagnose disc herniation? Well, in terms of diagnostic imaging, if you use radiograph, I would strongly encourage to start by doing plain X-rays before to consider myelogram. However, the X-ray may have limitations. They can be normal with disc herniation, but they can also sometimes give you clue that there may be a process of disc disease. An example here will be on a chondrodystrophic breed. You can see that at this level, there is a calcified disc, but that only tells you the disc is degenerated. It doesn't mean he has extruded. However, when you look at the foramen, you can see that there is some opacity within the foramen that could, you know, suggest the presence of a disc extrusion. The intervertebral disc space is narrowed. There is narrowing of the foramen and narrowing between the facet. And that could be a sign of disc extrusion. Now, you will still need to perform a malogram to confirm the diagnosis. But the aim of the malogram as well will be to tell you the boundary of the extrusion, so how much you need to open in craniocaudal border, but also if you have to go on the right or on the left. Malography will be necessary unless you have access to advanced imaging like CT or MRI. And with malogram, you will see typically with disc herniation and extradural compression that could be at the level of the disc like this one, or a more lateral extradural compression like this one if the disc has extruded on the side. In a case like that, you will have obviously to consider over differential for lateralized extradural compression, including a bleed, potentially an empyema, and if the sign were more slow in onset, a spinal cord or spinal tumor. MRI is the imaging modality of choice to diagnose disc herniation, whether extrusion or protrusion. And this is an example of a cat. We're looking at the caudal lumbar spine, and you can see that this disc is dehydrated compared to the adjacent one, L7S1, L6, L7 here. And you got a very large disc extrusion on this sagittal view. On this view here, you can see the disc has extruded, and the spinal cord is sitting above, being severely compressed by the extrusion. The advantage of MRI is also to diagnose when the disc has extruded outside of the vertebral canal. A good example here, we're looking at the cervical spine. This dog was showing severe nerve root sinature and pain on palpation on one side of the neck where it was lame, and you can see that the spinal cord is totally normal, not being compressed within the canal. Here we've got the foramen, and you can see that just on the exit of the foramen, the disc has extruded and obviously causing severe compression of the spinal nerve and all the pain and nerve root sinature. This you won't be able to diagnose it on the malogram, as the malogram will only fill up the subarachnoid space, showing you the shape of the spinal cord, and you won't be able to diagnose this less frequent disc extrusion. With this disease, it's very important to consider from a clinical point of view the severity of the sign, and to do that, I look at the number of spinal cord function that has been lost. So clinically, I assess the dog in terms of proprioceptive function, motor function, bladder function, and nociception, which is when you test the pain sensation. Why we do that? Because all the cable in the spinal cord that are responsible for transmitting this modality are organized in a different way in terms of depth within the spinal cord. The more superficial cable are the proprioceptive cable, and therefore they are usually the first one to be affected. When you go deeper and the problem get worse, then you affect the motor cable, and therefore after being wobbly on the leg, you get weakness and ultimately paralysis. Then you may lose bladder control, and the last spinal cord function to be lost is the lack of pain sensation. This is the basis for a grading system that we use, but we use it only for paraparetic or paraplegic dog and cat. Depending on the number of spinal cord function, we give a grade on a clinical basis to this patient. And in theory, the problem gets worse in one direction and tend to improve in the reverse direction. And this grading system has a number of advantages. It helps you to predict the outcome in terms of giving the odd for recovery to the owner, depending on what grade, which grade you are, and we come back to that. It's also a good way to follow the recovery of the patient and to plan nursing care in a way that if you have an animal paraplegic with no nociception, you know that he must have no bladder function, and therefore you need to address the bladder, either emptying the bladder manually or putting an undwelling catheter. So what are the treatment options for this disease? It comes down to two modalities, conservative or surgical management. Conservative management consists of 4 weeks of strict crate or cage rest. And during these 4 weeks, you will instruct the owner to take the animal out for very short walk, only for toilet purpose, and always on the leash. At the end of the 4 weeks, I usually recommend 2 weeks of room rest, where you will slowly increase the exercise on the lead before the animal is allowed to return to normal activity after 6 weeks. During that period, you should use medication as analgesic, and I use, on that case, non-steroidal. You may add to that, if it's not sufficient, gabapentin or pregabalin. And in the acute phase, if the animal is very sore, I will prefer to hospitalize the dog for a day or two, giving opioid analgesia, either methadone or and followed by buprenorphine if the animal becomes more comfortable. After that, sending the dog home on non-steroidal plus or minus tramadol plus or minus gabapentin or pregabalin. And the aim will be for the animal to be back to normal after 2 weeks. And after that, you will slowly reduce the medication over week 3, leaving the animal off medication on week 4. So when do I suggest this conservative management? I will recommend in first opinion practice to consider that mostly if an animal is presented with spinal pain with no or very, very subtle neurological deficit. I mean by that the animal may have a very, you know, a subtle stiff gait, very subtle proprioceptive deficit. Anything else, I will tend to advise investigation and consider surgery if appropriate. In what I mean by that, if you confirm it is a slip disc and if there is sufficient compression to justify decompressive surgery. The outcome of conservative management on this grade 1 to grade 2 patient, which are only pain and minimum neurological sign, is exactly the same as surgical. And that's the reason why, in first opinion, I will recommend to try conservative first, but you need to very carefully monitor this dog because some of them may quickly get worse. The overall outcome, about 90%, which would be the same as surgery. However, one third of them, of this dog treated with conservative management may have recurrence. Surgery, I tend to recommend if it's anything else. So either a patient that have more obvious neurological sign, or a patient that where the pain cannot be controlled despite medical management, or a dog that failed to respond to conservative treatment or get worse during the treatment or keep relapsing. All this will be clear indication to consider surgery and obviously before that to investigate to confirm the diagnosis of disc herniation and make a decision if decompressive surgery is indicated or not. In terms of surgery, to give you a brief overview, the one that we frequently use for thoracolumbar or lumbar disc will be the so-called hemilaminectomy, where we remove half of the lamina and the pedicle on each side of the intervertebral foramen, which is an example here. And if you take the analogy of a house to describe a spine, we remove half of the roof, one side of the wall, to get inside the house. There are variations of emmilaminectomy called foraminotomy or mini-emmilaminectomy where we leave the articular facet intact, or pediculectomy where we only remove one pedicle if the disc material is sitting not at the level of the intervertebral disc but has migrated at the level of the vertebral body. For the neck, the surgery we commonly do, as the disc tend to herniate ventrally, is the so-called ventral slot. And if we take again this analogy of a house, we're going through the basement to get access to the vertebral canal. The aim of the surgery in both of these cases is to take away the part of the disc that have herniated, compared to human, where very often they will consider disc replacement surgery. What is the prognosis of disc herniation? It depends whether or not the disc has herniated in the neck or in the thoracolumbar region in the neck. The prognosis is generally good, especially very good if the animal is still able to walk before surgery. And you can see that if he's not able to walk before surgery, it's about 62%. Not surprising, the outcome is better for a small dog than a giant breed of dog. But overall, most dogs tend to recover fairly quickly within the first week or two in terms of ability to ambulate. With thoracolumbar disc, it depends again on the neurological exam and the presence or not of nociception. If an animal has lost nociception, then it is an emergency and surgery should be ideally performed in the first 24 hours, in which case the chance for recovery is about 60%. If the animal is left longer, then the prognosis tend to fall very quickly, and it falls below 10% if the animal has lost nociception past 48 hours. Otherwise, if the animal still have nociception, most animals tend to recover within the first 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the degree of disability prior to surgery. I just wanted to mention an unusual type of disc herniation, where in that case, the main issue is the contusion and there is no or minimum compression, and is what has been referred in the past wrongly as type 3 disc herniation. The correct terminology that is adopted these days is acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion. And this clearly describes what's happening. There is a small piece of nucleus pulposus that will herniate with causing mostly contusion of the spinal cord and no or minimum compression. The way to diagnose them is usually with MRI. You will see that the nucleus pulposus is smaller on the affected disc than the adjacent one, and you can see that this one, the volume is much smaller. You got the minimum compression there and contusion within the spinal cord, that's the sagittal view, and that's the transverse view. The treatment is, in that case, again, supportive care, exactly the same modality than with ischemic myelopathy, and there is no justification for decompressive surgery, as the pathological effect here is the contusion and not the compression. Example here on a cat it was an older cat where two of his lumbar discs have had this phenomenon of non-compressive nuclear disc extrusion. And this cat, despite having two discs that have extruded like that, made a full recovery within 3 to 4 weeks. The third condition we're going to discuss, exogenous spinal trauma. The most common cause for that will be a road traffic accident or if it's a cat, not only road traffic accident, but making a fall from a tree, for example. And with acute exogenous spinal trauma, the main injury will be obviously the primary injury, which are the parenchymal and vascular lesions that take place at the time of the injury, which are usually out of reach for the clinician. And as we've seen already, This quickly leads to the secondary injury phenomenon, this vascular, ionic and biochemical event that slowly aggravate the primary injury. In terms of pathological effect, what you need to remember with exogenous spinal trauma is three things will happen to the spinal cord to various degree depending on the primary insult. There will be contusion of the spinal cord, there may be compression, and the compression could be a traumatic disc rupture, it could be a rupture of the blood vessel causing an hematoma, pressing on the spinal cord, it could be compression due to a bony fragment, and then you may have as well some degree of instability. Why I'm showing you that is that we could spend really hours on exogenous spinal trauma, but if you have that in mind, these three pathological events, that's what we're going to hunt when we diagnose, when we do diagnostic imaging, and that's what we're going to base our treatment modality. You should know better than anyone else, being following emergency critical care webinar, that with an exogenous spinal trauma, you need first to focus on the rest of the body and not the spinal cord, and mostly to focus on vital function. It's very important to consider that a lot of these animals, if they've been hit by a car, may be unstable systemically, and you need to address their ABC before to consider even a neurological exam. In terms of spinal cord function, as we've seen, there is no magic drug to prevent the secondary injury phenomenon, but the best way to limit the secondary injury phenomenon is to make sure that the spinal cord is well perfused, so you need to correct any hypoperfusion due to hypovolemic shock. You need to make sure that the blood is well oxygenated, and with not too much carbon dioxide, which will have nefast effect on the control of the brain, but also the spinal cord perfusion. The other thing to consider, especially in cats that may have been left on the side of the road, is to restore, if abnormal, the body temperature. So, very important to focus on the ABC and temperature. That will be very important in terms of limiting the secondary injury phenomenon. And after that, you can, when the animal is more stable, focus on the neurological exam. That will help you to know which limbs are affected, assessing the reflex, but also, as a prognostic indicator, the nociception. An example here of this dog with severe lung injury, but also this animal here have a complete dislocation, the caudal thoracic spine. This dog was paraplegic with no nociception. Having that degree of overriding between the vertebrae leave no chance for recovery or spinal cord function. So going back again, remember, with exogenous spinal trauma, focus on the ABC to try to correct any major life-threatening abnormality, and also limit the spinal cord injury. In terms of treatment itself for spinal cord injury, beyond the systemic stabilization, same thing as with disc herniation or ischemic myelopathy, there is very little evidence that the use of methylprednisolone serum succinate has a beneficial effect in dog and cat. In human, there is an effect, but this effect is minimum, mostly seen in terms of improvement in motor function at 6 months, but the degree of improvement at 6 months in a human may not translate to a significant improvement to be a cat and a dog. So personally, I don't tend to use solimedrone. I'm not saying it would be a mistake to use it, but I personally don't use it. In terms of surgical treatment, when to consider it, it very much depends if on your investigation you can identify there is compression and or instability. In terms of compression, the way to diagnose that would be either doing myelogram or ideally CT or MRI. With regard to stability, it is something that you will best assess initially with radiograph, and radiograph that you will do on an animal conscious to avoid creating more instability if there was instability in the first place. And the way I tend to assess that, there are many different schemes, is mostly to look at two things, the ventral and the dorsal compartment. The dorsal compartment is probably the most important one, which is the ventral buttress, which the vertebral body is the main responsible for. And if there is fracture of the vertebral body, this type of fracture are most of the time inherently unstable. The other thing that I will consider as unstable spine will be if there is rupture of the intervertebral disc and also disruption in the alignment between the facet. In that case, this kind of dog and cat are also inherently unstable. So two situations to consider instability: fracture of the vertebral body and or rupture of the intervertebral disc, and also some fracture or lack of congruity between the articular facet. Both of them will require some form of stabilization. Here are some examples of what we can do. An example on cat with instability between T13LL1 that was treated surgically with screw and methymetacrylate. But there are different modalities which go beyond this presentation. I wanted to finish this presentation discussing another type of exogenous spinal trauma which can cause a lot of headache in practice, which is the so-called tail pull injury or sacrococcygeal dislocation. And here is an example here of a cat where you can see a dislocation between the sacrum and also the tail. So what's happening in this cat? This cat have tail pull injury can present with a number of neurological signs. But before we discuss them, let's look at what is happening in the lower part of the lumbar and lumbosacral spine in terms of neural structure. In this part of the spine, you've got the spinal cord segment and the spinal nerve root that will give rise to the sciatic nerve, pudendal, pelvic, and caudal nerve. The caudal nerve is what's responsible for sensation and motricity of the tail. Pudendal and pelvic nerve are responsible for anal and urethral sphincter, bladder control, and rectal smooth muscle control, while the sciatic nerve is responsible for flexion of the stifle, flexion extension of the tarsus and the digit, as well as sensation in the inner thigh. So, what do we see usually in this cat with tail pull injury? They are usually presented to you with a flaccid tail. However, the flaccid tail is usually the tip of the iceberg. Why that is, while the dislocation takes place between either the sacrum and the first coccygeal, or between the first coccygeal vertebrae itself, the pulling injury there tend to pull the cauda equina, and there is a traction injury that takes place at the level of the cauda equina. The point of least resistance, which would be the point where there would be the damage, are usually where the cauda equina attach to the spinal cord segment, which is the nerve root, which don't are more sensitive to the traction injury. And the nerve root that you will find there are not only the nerve root responsible for the tail movement, but also the sensation of the bladder, the pudendal nerve responsible for the constriction of the urethral sphincter, as well as the constriction of the anal sphincter. So while the animal is presented to you with a flaccid tail, the main issue is going to be the bladder control and the sometimes also the rectal control as well. Usually, these cats have a fairly easily expressible bladder for the first few days, but very rapidly they develop what we call reflex sphincter dyssynergia, where the bladder becomes very tough to express. And the reason for that is not only the urethral sphincter as a somatic innervation via the pudendal nerve, but also an autonomic innervation via the hypogastric nerve. And when you lose the pudendal nerve innervation, the autonomic one via the hypogastric nerve will become overreactive. And that's why this cat go through having a very easily expressible bladder to having a very tight urethral sphincter, making the bladder expression very difficult after a few days. Should you do MRI if you have a cat presented to you with a flaccid tail? I will definitely do an X-ray, and I will tell you why in a sec. But if the X-ray show a tail pull injury, there is very little benefit to do an MRI scan unless you suspect there could be two lesions. So in terms of motor function, this cat with tail pull injury are able to walk. They may have very subtle weakness, very subtle proprioceptive deficit, but where the lesion takes place, it should not affect the ability to walk. If you have a cat with a tail pull injury and there is very obvious paraparesis, then it means there must be a second lesion. And in that case, yes, I will recommend to do advanced imaging to look for the second lesion. But if there is only one clinically, and radiographically you see a tail pull injury, then doing an MRI scan like on this case will not give you more information. Especially, it will not tell you if the neural injury will be permanent or not, which means it doesn't allow you to see if the nerve root is transected and or if it will, the function will return. We will see in a minute how to establish the prognosis. But why I will encourage you to always do an X-ray is to confirm the diagnosis of tail pull injury. And if you don't find a tail pull injury, then you may consider advanced imaging. But also, the X-ray may help you to see a condition that could mimic a tail pull injury. And this cat, you can see a beautiful catogram there, was presented with tail pull injury following a suspected trauma. Going a bit, if we magnified, you will see that there is no evidence of sacrococcygeal dislocation there. However, there is here a fracture of L7 vertebral body. And remember what we say about spinal fracture. If there is vertebral body fracture, they are inherently unstable. And in that case, the presentation will be exactly the same as what you will see with a tail pull injury, but the management will be totally different. Where on this cat, if there is a clear indication of the need for spinal fixation. Here you can see the CT scan that we did for surgical planning. You can see a fracture of the body of L7. And we treated that cat with a screw and methyl methacrylate. So in that case, the sign were mimicking tail pull injury, but the underlying cause was a fracture of L7, and the treatment will be, in that case, spinal fixation. With tail pull injury, there is no indication at all to put the tail, the dislocation to treat it surgically, as it will not affect the outcome, as the level of injury is cranial to where the dislocation has taken place. So we've seen that this cat can be difficult to manage after a few days. Initially, what I will recommend is to monitor the urination, monitor the size of the bladder. If they don't urinate, express the bladder twice a day. If it becomes very difficult to express, then I will recommend to use a drug to try to loosen the urethral sphincter, and the drug I commonly use are prazosin and diazepam, starting at the lower dose, bringing up to a higher dose. I also use lactulose to soften their feces. A lot of this cat will become constipated, sometimes as well due to pain, and if they become constipated, microlax. Finally, some cats may develop later on, after a few weeks, chronic hyperesthesia, and they may want have a tendency to mutilate their tail, and I will use for that any of these following medication, gabapentin or pregabalin, amantadine or amitriptyline, to try to treat this chronic hyperesthesia. If you still struggle to express the bladder despite this medication, then I will tend to use a cystotomy tube. The advantage of putting that tube is that it allowed to monitor the cat return of spontaneous urination while emptying the bladder at the same time. While if you put a urethral sphincter, the issue is that you never know when, if the cat has recovered the ability to urinate. So you will have to pull the catheter, monitor, and then put him back if he doesn't. While a cystotomy tube avoid that. When I put a cystotomy tube, I will usually consider then removing the tail at the same time, all in one go. And the advantage of doing that is to prevent further tail pull injury. In terms of prognosis, the prognosis is generally good if you still have sensation at the base of the tail and the perineum. If you lack sensation there, the chance to recover the ability to urinate is about 60%. And if the animal is meant to recover, so the 60% that will recover will do so in the first 4 weeks. So in terms of prognosis, check this tail-based sensation. If it's absent, tell the owner 60% chance to recover and to suggest to give at least 4 weeks to see if he regained the ability to urinate. As I already say, when do we consider amputation of the tail? If I have to put a cystotomy tube and the animal has absent tail-based sensation, if the animal mutilates his tail and you can't control it with the drug, or if there is severe degloving injury. That's it for this presentation. I hope you've enjoyed it and give you an overview of common acute spinal disease, and I'll be happy to take any question you may have. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laurent for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.